counsel this morning on the final merit case, 10-298, New Destiny Treatment Center, and Marie Wheeler. It's Marie Wheeler, appellant, versus New Destiny Treatment Center. Chief Justice O'Connor will not be watching this one because she is recused, and Judge Richard Rogers from the Third District Court of Appeals will be sitting in her place. With that, I believe we're ready to begin. Mr. Petroff.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer. May it please this honorable court, I am Alan Petrov. I represent the Akron firm of Roderick Linton. I will be sharing an argument this morning with Mr. Sullivan, who represents Marie Wheeler. I will present the argument in chief. We'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Sullivan will present that argument. But may it please the court, this case, in my view, presents an important case in the area of legal malpractice, and in particular, addressing the issue of who has standing to present a claim for legal malpractice following a struggle for control of an entity. And I respectfully submit that the place to begin the analysis is with a discussion of the attorney-client relationship. What are the attributes of an attorney-client relationship? What does an attorney-client relationship require of the attorney and entitle the client to? And why are our rules concerning attorney-client relationships the way they are? So we begin with the proposition that an attorney-client relationship is a relationship of mutual trust and confidence. It is a relationship that cannot be unilaterally created. I cannot impose myself as an attorney upon a client, and a client cannot impose himself upon me absent my consent. An attorney-client relationship is not an ordinary commercial relationship. It is a relationship that is fiduciary in nature and imposes duties of loyalty and single-mindedness to the attorney.
Mr. Petroff, I'm going to jump you ahead, but before I do, I'll stay with your initial subject matter for a moment. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court, correct?
It did.
And started talking about clean hands, and it seemed to me the focus was that your client got paid a pretty healthy sum of money, I assume out of the treasury of this nonprofit corporation that your client says his firm or the associate in his firm or whatever relationship. I don't want to quarrel about what her status was, wasn't representing them, was only representing a faction. And it seemed to me that the problem with that argument is there doesn't seem to be a dispute that a good chunk of change came out of the treasury of this corporation while this dispute was going on. And how could that happen if there wasn't representation of the entity?
There are really two aspects to your question. The one is the payment of fees, and the other is what bearing does it have upon an attorney-client relationship. And I submit to you, Your Honor, that the payment of fees has never been part of the analysis of whether an attorney-client relationship exists. Many lawyers have argued in cases, well, I didn't get a fee, I couldn't have been their attorney. And that argument doesn't travel very
but
far.
How many have argued, I did get a fee, but I couldn't have been their attorney?
Well, there are situations. The model rules allow for the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct recognize that there are situations in which fees will be paid by individuals other than the client. An insurance company and insurer is an example, parent and child. There are statutes that authorize nonprofit corporations and for-profit corporations to pay fees incurred on behalf of officers and directors. And in those situations, the client remains the client. The client is not the individual that paid the fees. Now, I recognize that this is a little different because, as a practical matter, there was a period of time when Mr. Hawthorne and his cohorts apparently had the ability to control the Treasury and to pay fees. But the payment of fees doesn't create the attorney-client relationship.
With the entity.
With the entity, all particularly right. When the entity is objecting to the attorney-client
right.
relationship.
And I understand all of that, and that, I mean, when we can talk about other matters like the lawsuit in which they were awarded, what, $1.5 million?
More than that.
And a big amount of money. But I want to jump you now down to what you argue, and I think it's your last proposition of law, and I was surprised that the other side is seeming to go to the merits of that rather than saying you need to send this back. And that is your argument that the statute of limitations has run. Procedurally, can we get to that?
We can.
You argue we can, and they don't argue you can't. The argument coming back is you're wrong about the start date of the statute. So my question is, we can figure out what we think the start date of the statute running is, but procedurally, can we get to that issue? Because if we can and if we agree with you on the start date of the statute, then we don't need to write anything about all of the rest of this.
You have the authority to do that, Your Honor. Our proposition is that the Court of Appeals had the obligation to address that alternative assignment of error. I'm not saying that you have the obligation as the court of last resort, but you have the authority, you have the power. It's proceedings that come before you on summary judgment. It's a de novo review, and you can look at the evidence presented to the trial court on the statute of limitations just as well as any other court can.
Am I misunderstanding the other side? They did not seem to argue against us addressing that question.
Well, their position, as I recall the brief, is that it's not a good defense, not that you don't have the jurisdiction and power and authority
to
adjudicate.
They argue about when the statute started to run,
Yes. Yeah. And while we're on the subject, our view is that Marie Wheeler was an attorney associated with Roderick Linton for only a portion of the time that she was counsel for the Hawthorne faction. All of this began in December of 2000. In February of 2001, she decided to...
I've taken you away from your lead argument.
It's okay.
I think we can understand the timing and the fact that she was gone from your clients...
In February.
In February, and that your client received a notice that representation, whatever it was terminated...
In February.
But received another notice in April that was would have, if we used that date, the statute was up 2 or 3 days before the suit was filed. Is that right?
Well, there's a dispute as to when Mr. Haley, the receiver, actually terminated Ms. Wheeler's ostensible authority. Was it April 21, April 25? But that's really Ms. Wheeler's issue, because with the Roderick Linton firm, it's clear that Ms. Wheeler was gone from the firm in February. The firm itself filed a notice with the court advising that it no longer was associated with the case and no longer represented anyone, and the record submitted to the trial court in this case is clear that BRM, the charity, was on notice of and complaining of Ms. Wheeler's perceived conflict of interest no later than January 2001. So as to Roderick Linton, they're on notice in January. Roderick Linton is removed from the case in February. Suit is not filed until a year later in April.
But the trial court never passed on that specific issue.
Trial court did not address it at all.
So you would have to make a finding. We'd have to send it back to the trial court for findings on those circumstances, wouldn't we?
I don't think you have to. It's It's a de novo review. You have all of the evidence before you in the record of the case. You have the same evidence here that the trial court would have if you sent it back.
Trial court never passed on the issue of the statute of limitations as to Roderick Linton.
No, that's correct.
The appellate court never did?
No one did.
So we'd be doing it in the first instance here.
You would be.
Counsel? There was a sizable judgment that the corporation eventually got against Mr. Hawthorne, correct?
Yes.
Was in that measure of damages, was any of the measure of damages, including the attorney fees that he supposedly used to pay Wheeler and Linton?
I don't know, but I don't believe so. I really don't know, and the record is a void on that aspect.
Was it a default, or?
It wasn't a default. It went to trial. It was a lengthy trial, and I think it was a $4 million judgment. It's many millions of dollars. But that lawsuit was filed on December 11, 2000. It was filed the same day that Mr. Hawthorne attempted the coup to take back control of the charity. So,
your position is that him taking money from the corporation to pay your clients was not determinative of the relationship between your attorneys and the dissidents who eventually, by court order, got control of the corporation.
I'm saying it's not determinative, and I'm also suggesting it isn't even relevant. The payment of fees doesn't influence or define an attorney-client relationship.
And Russell and Lupton never approved payment of fees in the times that they claimed they had control. They never approved payment of fees to Wheeler or...
They never approved the payment of fees. They never approved of Marie Wheeler or anything that she did. The typical legal malpractice case is one in which a client comes to court and says, I hired this person as my attorney. I relied on them. I listened to them. I depended upon them. I trusted them. And look at the mess that I'm in. This case is just the opposite. The plaintiff comes into court and says, they weren't my attorney. It's only a purported relationship. It was held to be void. The evidence establishes that no one in a position of authority, of true authority at the charity, ever relied on anything that Marie Wheeler did. And not only did they not rely, they disputed all of her conduct. They disputed her status as counsel. They disputed her strategy. They disputed her plan. She was retained to help Hawthorne reassume control of the charity. And the charity, acting through the people who had authority to act for it, didn't agree. They put up roadblock after roadblock after roadblock.
So you're saying they're stopped from asserting a malpractice cause against her because the whole argument is she wasn't their lawyer.
I'm saying...
Is estoppel your argument?
Well, my first argument is that there is no attorney-client relationship as a matter of law, and that the pleadings that say we're basing this claim on a purported void relationship are insufficient. My second argument is that they can't change their position. Having prevailed in the Common Pleas Court and the Quo Warranto case on issues relating to authority, they argued Ms. Wheeler's not our counsel, and the trial court accepted that proposition. They argued that Hawthorne had no authority to hire her, and the Court of Appeals accepted that position. And I'm saying they're judicially stopped from now advancing a contrary argument in this case when it meets the exigency of a particular moment.
Thank you. Mr. Petroff.
I'm really out of time.
Yeah. Your co-counsel would like
unless there are any questions, I will sit down and ask the court to reverse and enter final judgment for both of the appellants.
We'll give you a little time in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, were you going now or were you going to do a rebuttal?
During the rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Michael Moran, your justices, on behalf of New Destiny, formerly known as the Barberton and Rescue Mission. Let me get that down a little bit. Is that better?
Yes.
The fundamental issue that this court is being asked to confront today is, can Roderick Linton and Marie Wheeler be held accountable for their actions that they performed on behalf of a client? And I think you need to figure out if these were legal services that were being performed. And I think the Court of Appeals addressed that issue very well. They noted that they gave advice to...
Well, we don't have to figure out in the first instance. You have to figure out in the first instance by what you plead. And what did you plead? Did you plead a malpractice case, or did you plead unjust enrichment?
We pled...
What did you plead?
We pled a malpractice case. We pled unjust enrichment. We pled negligent misrepresentation, and we pled fraudulent misrepresentation, Your Honor.
Okay. And what did the Court of Appeals decide the case on?
The Court of Appeals, Your Honor, determined that it was a malpractice action, that the attorney-client relationship was, in fact,
formed. And did you file a cross-appeal here?
Did not, Your Honor.
So you're foreclosed on anything but malpractice?
To the extent that this Court would reverse and remand to the Court of Appeals for further decision, but if they would not, I think that is correct.
In the judgment that you got against Mr. Hawthorne, that's a corporate judgment, or is that a personal judgment from Lupton and Russell?
That is a corporate judgment.
And is Hawthorne collectible?
Hawthorne is not collectible, Your Honor.
Because I was trying to understand why you are pursuing this action in face of all of the quotes from your clients about them not being your attorney, so you're looking after somebody that has a pocket, essentially.
Well, Your Honor, we are looking toward someone who we believe performed improperly as a professional for Barberton Rescue Mission.
And considering all of the positions you took, that they had no authority, they were not attorneys for your clients, et cetera, all those quotes that are rampant throughout the case, what is the basis of the malpractice claim? How do you commit malpractice to somebody who is saying to you repeatedly, you're not my attorney, during the course of that alleged representation?
I think it is whom is the client. The Board of Trustees, the true Board of Trustees, the lawful Board of Trustees, opposed Marie Wheeler and Roderick Linton's actions and rejected them as not being the proper actions of Barberton Rescue Mission.
So the true board of this corporation said to Wheeler and Linton, you are not our attorneys.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
However, they...
How then do you get to an attorney-client position when the client is saying, you are not my attorney?
Because I do not accept the premise that the Board of Trustees is the Barberton Rescue Mission. It is merely a group of individuals who are representatives of the Barberton Rescue Mission, but are not
okay,
the corporate
who
entity.
Who can say, who has the right to say in words, if it's not the board, who in the Barberton Rescue Mission said to these people, you are our attorneys?
We believe that Bruce Hawthorne did as president and CEO of that entity. He signed an hourly and contingent
fee. But you maintain he had, and you won a judgment saying he had no authority to do that, so he has no authority to bind the corporation, and you have a judgment that says so, don't you?
No, we do not, Your Honor.
What does your judgment say? Doesn't it reinstate Russell and Lipton and that board as the lawful board?
That's right, but it did not determine that he did not have authority to enter into contracts. It merely determined that the Board of Trustees that he created with Marie Wheeler and Roderick Linton's help was illegal and void and their actions taken. This is a contract that was signed by the president of that entity prior to any action taken by that board, and it was reported to that rump Board of Trustees that Marie Wheeler had been retained for the Barberton Rescue Mission. Not to represent Bruce Hawthorne, but to retain, to represent the Barberton Rescue Mission.
But what was the status of Hawthorne at the time that this took place on December 11th? He was on a leave of absence or suspended? What was that status?
He was on a leave of absence. The bylaws of the organization indicate that the president has various duties and responsibilities and rights and powers, I guess I should say, and one of them is the power to enter into contract. It does not address what rights, powers, or obligations the president may have when he is on a leave of absence.
Well, he was on the leave of absence. Who was the chief executive officer or the chief operating officer, if there are two different people?
Probably Reverend Russell and others within the organization filling in and acting on behalf of the organization while Reverend Hawthorne was on his leave of absence.
They never ratified this contract or accepted this contract with Wheeler and Lipton?
No, Your Honor, they rejected it.
And Mr. Petroff would argue that you are now judicially estopped because of these contrary positions that have been taken to the position taken here. What is your strongest argument in response to the estoppel claim?
Well, I don't believe anyone has ever determined, any court anywhere has ever determined, Your Honor, that they were not the attorneys for this organization. That's number one. And number two, they're a stop from even raising that argument. This is an they took positions before the court. They filed pleadings on behalf of this organization and vigorously in several courts argued that they were the attorneys for this organization. And now that that turned out to be untrue and false, they now want to say, well, we didn't have any professional responsibilities to that organization that we sought to represent and were paid significant sums of money for the performance of legal services.
If we were to accept your position, if we were to accept your position, then doesn't this create precedential case law that any time there are disputes within boards of any type of board, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's a profit board, when one faction loses and the other faction wins, the winning faction can sue the attorneys representing the losing faction?
No, I don't think that occurs. I think there has to be further actions that were taken where there were conflicts of interest, perhaps. Further, there has to be negligence, professional negligence. This was a takeover, hostile in the true sense of the word, of physical possession of this enterprise, this charitable organization.
And that happens a lot of times in these corporate disputes, and sometimes the hostile takeover person wins in court. And then they now, under your theory, can sue the attorneys for anybody that loses in that hostile takeover.
It would depend on whether or not there was malpractice committed. I don't think it's winning and losing. I think it's whether or not there were malpractice.
Well, they've always been alleged malpractice, like you did. They gave bad advice. Look at the trouble they caused us. Look at all the bad decisions they made that prevented us from running the corporation. That's all malpractice.
And all the harm that they caused while they were doing it. That is very true.
Well, counsel, following up on that, since this case arises in Summit County, I'm thinking back to Sir Robert Goldsmith and his attempt to take over Goodyear. And eventually the board paid him green mail, I think, to get him to go away.
They did.
So the lawyer that advises him to do green mail or the lawyer that advised Goldsmith to try and do a hostile takeover could be subject to, I suppose you would say, depending on the facts.
Your Honor, it does depend on the facts, and I want to make sure that the court's clear on this hostile takeover. That may have been a bad group of words for me. I am not talking about a legally hostile takeover. I am talking about a physical takeover of the facility, the money, and the personnel.
Because the legality of this depended on whether or not they had a majority vote of the board. And as I understand it, that depended on whether or not a board member who had essentially been kicked off
was
off the board or on the board. They counted that board member, and the courts, the Ninth District, has essentially said you couldn't count that board member, so you were one vote light, and therefore you couldn't do what you thought you could do.
That is correct.
Summing that up. Let me move you to the statute of limitations, because while we enjoy the intellectual exercise that you lawyers have presented us here, if we disagree with your point of view as to when the statute of limitations on the — there's a one-year statute, right, for malpractice?
There is, Your Honor.
If we disagreed with your position as to when it started and agreed with the other side as to when it started, then the statute would have run. That's a quick and easy way out of this case for us. We don't even have to write very much. Your briefs seem to focus on when the statute did or did not start to run, and what's been nagging at me since I saw that is, how do we get to that issue?
Well, Your Honor, we also did argue that the appellate court is not required to assume the duties of the trial court. We cited the Murphy case dealing
with — My question is, we're not required to, but if we saw that as an easy backdoor out of this case, and I shouldn't be that dismissive of our alternatives, there's no point to continuing the litigation if, in the end, this case is going to be gone due to a statute of limitations problem. I mean, if that is truly present in the case, if we can procedurally get to that, shouldn't we get to it?
I believe that you may. I do not believe you should. And I believe the Court of Appeals believed that it might, but also did not believe that it should without a full record being created. One of the issues that the Court of Appeals was very delicate about was the exact date of when Marie Wheeler's termination occurred. They cited April, and that is because of the factual dispute, which was inadvertently created of April 21 through April 25th. Another issue that has to be determined is whether or not there was a cognizable event that occurred and when it occurred.
Well, you argue it didn't occur until the Court of Appeals told you the outcome of the case that
and
was
that is
that.
When the entity itself, as opposed to the Board of Trustees, the lawful Board of Trustees, first realizes that the Hawthorne Board is not properly constituted, was unauthorized in its activities that it was undertaking. And I believe that's similar to the point that Justice Stratton was making concerning when do you know?
So, with respect to Linton, the facts aren't in dispute. We could look at his part of the case and say it's either when he served notice that he's no longer involved and his firm is no longer involved, or it's when the Court of Appeals decided the case. It's one of the two. One's inside the statute, one's outside.
That would certainly be one way of looking at it.
But with respect to Wheeler, there's a factual dispute.
With respect to Wheeler, there is clearly a factual dispute about the date of termination. There would also be an issue, I believe, with respect to the effect of Mr. Pruneski's correspondence or filing of a pleading with the court telling the court that he's leaving now, or Roderick Linton is leaving now. I don't believe there was any court order authorizing the withdrawal of Roderick Linton as counsel.
Counsel, what is the procedural posture of this case at the trial court level? We're discussing here the malpractice action. You indicate that you've pled at least three other causes of action. Are they still pending in the trial court, or is this whole thing here together?
They were all claims in this same action. The Court of Appeals deeming the malpractice action, deeming there to be an attorney-client relationship, therefore malpractice to be the appropriate remedy, merged the unjust enrichment, the negligent misrepresentation, fraudulent misrepresentations into the malpractice action, saying it's all malpractice when you have an attorney-client relationship.
For the purpose of argument only, if we should determine that there is no attorney-client relationship in malpractice, should this then be remanded to the trial court to consider the other claims, or where should this case go in if that should arise?
I believe if you reverse the decision that there is an attorney-client relationship, then it should go back to the trial court with instructions to consider whether or not there are other claims that were undecided at that level, and indeed undecided at the appellate level when the merger occurs, because that court never reached that decision either.
That's what you would like to have happen, but I'm having a hard time understanding how that can happen if you haven't filed a cross appeal.
And I agreed with the court on that.
The trial court granted summary judgment, so if we reverse the Ninth District, it goes back to summary judgment. There's no way back in for you, is there?
I don't know.
Thank you.
Moran,
Thank you. We
write rules of law here, and everything I hear in your argument is that it's so factually specific and there are such undetermined factual claims. What rule of law should we write here if we agree with your position?
I don't think you should write any rule of law other than the ones that tell you it's facts specific as to whether or not an attorney-client relationship exists, and that these facts establish the existence of that relationship.
Based on these facts, you think the holding of this case from our court should be that this does, in fact, establish an attorney-client relationship, and that's all you really want?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Moran. Mr. Sullivan.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Brian Sullivan. I have the pleasure of representing Ms. Wheeler in this afternoon's appeal. I'd like to briefly try to address some of the questions that have been raised. First and foremost, the plaintiff's argument that these proceedings that have been raised in these proceedings, that an attorney-client relationship exists, is not faithful to the pleadings, to the complaint in this action. Specifically, paragraph 3 of plaintiff's complaint indicates or avers that defendant, the attorneys, provided advice to certain members of the Board of Trustees of the Mission that purported to result in an attorney-client relationship. Nowhere in the complaint do they allege that an actual attorney-client relationship exists. And I would submit that in part the reason for that is because the corporation, the entity, the Mission itself, did not retain Ms. Wheeler or Roderick Linton. Ms. Wheeler was retained on behalf of Bruce Hawthorne to represent his interest in reasserting himself and those who are acting in concert with him in control of the organization. Mr. Hawthorne was on a forced leave of absence beginning in May of 2000. In November of 2000, that leave of absence was extended by the board. At no time did he have the apparent, actual, or implied authority to retain Ms. Wheeler or Roderick Linton on behalf of the organization itself.
And how does a law firm get paid out of the corporate treasury?
Well, I would submit that Reverend Hawthorne, Bruce Hawthorne, authorized those payments, and as Mr. Petroff indicated, the payment of legal fees does not in and of itself establish the existence of an attorney-client relationship. This court recognized in Disciplinary Counsel versus Hardiman that the failure to pay does not negate the existence of an attorney-client relationship, and we would submit that the converse is equally true.
There, what is your view about if we should rule as you ask, what happens to this case? Was there a summary judgment on the entire case in the trial court or a partial summary judgment on the malpractice issue?
Summary judgment was granted on all counts in the plaintiff's complaint. That was appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed the summary judgment on count one, the legal malpractice, and affirmed summary judgment as it relates to the remaining claims. There's been no cross appeal of the Court of Appeals decision to this court. So we would submit that if this court reverses the Court of Appeals, judgment in favor of defendants would be the appropriate remedy, and that there would not be the need or the necessity to remand this case back to the trial court. One final point. I see that my time is expiring, if I may. Justice Stratton, I believed you had asked whether or not or what the basis of the malpractice was that was alleged below. The basis of the malpractice was that there was a conflict of interest, an inherent conflict of interest by the defendants in representing both the Hawthorne faction and the corporate entity. And I would submit that under those circumstances, this event is likely to occur in the future. As you pointed out, Justice Stratton, throughout the state, boards frequently have disagreements. Not infrequently, those disagreements ripen into disputes over controls for the organization. If the malpractice is that there's a conflict of interest where the person who is seeking corporate accountability retains a lawyer to assist in asserting control over the organization, attorneys hired to represent these dissident factions will be subject to malpractice claims if their clients are unsuccessful in establishing control. And we would submit that that would have a chilling effect on lawyers' interest in representing dissident shareholders or minority directors who attempt to seek heightened corporate accountability.
Counsel, just a matter of curiosity, that this charity apparently had a pretty large treasury. Is that correct?
At various points in time, Your Honor, yes, there was a substantial
amount. Big enough to attract the Attorney General's interest in allegations that your client's client was living large off the corporate treasury. How big a purse was he controlling?
Well, I believe that it was substantial.
That has give a little fleshing out to that.
I know that the monetary judgment that was awarded on behalf of the organization against Mr. Hawthorne was in the tune of, I believe, $4 million. And that, as I understand it, was a complaint that was prosecuted in large part based upon the allegation that Reverend Hawthorne misappropriated the entity's funds for his own personal gain.
To the tune of $4 million?
I believe the actual award against him individually was in the neighborhood of the compensatory award was in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. There was also a punitive award.
This is a big charity.
It was substantial. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank the court for its consideration.
Thank you. The case is submitted, and the counsel are dismissed at this point. We have one more matter to consider. You will be advised of the outcome at the appropriate time.